This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Congressman Fred Upton has been serving Southwest Michigan in the House since the mid-1980s. Several of his fellow Republican representatives have decided not to run for re-election. Upton hasn't said what he plans to do next year. Now that he's here, we're going to ask him. Welcome back.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here. Good to see you.
There's been a lot of speculation about your political future. Anything you can tell us yet?
Well, I can tell you a couple of things. Number one, I would not be doing these 10, 12, 14-hour days, often 6, 7 days a week, if we had made the decision not to run. But frankly, it's just a little bit too early. In my life, my family's always tried to be first, the job second, the campaign third. And to bring the campaign into play with more than a year before the election is just not something we've ever done. In fact, when I first ran for office, we didn't actually make the decision until December, and we didn't actually announce until March of the election year. So it's just a little bit too early. Some of my colleagues who are retiring, they've got filing deadlines literally in the next couple of weeks when they have to circulate petitions. In Michigan, it's not till April. You know, I was anticipating your question, so I'm thinking of some of the big Republicans that have retired from Michigan. Dave Camp, Mike Rogers, Vern Ehlers, they were all March or April when they made their decision public. And, it's only September.
True, but so we've already had one retirement in Michigan this year. Paul Mitchell?
Paul Mitchell, yeah. And Paul, number of circumstances, he's got a 9 or 10-year-old, a special needs child. You know, for Paul, he has a little advantage over me in that he has a direct flight. He's on the east side of the state. For me, it's, usually Grand Rapids, more often Kalamazoo or South Bend. There's a connection flight. I'm going to be a little grumpy next week when I go back to Washington, and that for 6 weeks I've not been there. The traffic's a lot better here. And it's also 12 hours a week that I don't have to spend traveling 6 hours one way, 12 hours round trip. So, but we'll make a decision in plenty of time. But to be somewhat direct, we've not made the decision not to run, and wouldn't be doing these days if in fact we'd made that. So we're checking all the boxes, and we'll make a decision at some point in the down the road.
I believe at this time 2 years ago, you were still considering a run for U.S. Senate.
That's right. I was. And we decided, I want to say it was in November, that we decided not to do that. And instead,
it would have been November of 17, right?
Yeah. So. So it's and that's was statewide, 83 counties, not six. And at the time we said we're going to concentrate on running for re-election. And that's exactly what we did.
So if you are going to be running for anything in 2020, is it going to be your House seat? Is there any chance you'd consider?
I'm not going to run for Senate. No, I guess. Oh, I didn't know what your question was going. No, I'm not going to run for the U.S. Senate.
House, it's House or nothing at this point?
Yeah. And part of the reason about the Senate, we gave it a lot of serious thought and thought we'd do well. You always think that going into it. Made the right decision not to run. Very comfortable with that. Talked to a lot of people on the other side of the state, all over, colleagues, governor, lots of different people. And when you run for Senate, and this was one of the factors then, you really have to run for two terms. I can guarantee you I'm not doing this when I'm 75 or 80. There are a lot of people that are that age and serving, particularly in the Senate, also in the House. Fred Upton's not going to be one of those guys.
Remind us how old you are now.
So it's actually hard to say. I'm 66, but I want you to quickly add, my cousin's son got married this last weekend, and I was asked legitimately, are you, so his name was Sam who got married, are you Sam's cousin, not uncle? I thought that was a pretty good compliment, and I did get carded at Wrigley Field this year, but I had a hat on.
Regardless of whether you are on the ballot or not, are next year's elections going to be secure?
They sure better be. I've sat in some classified briefings, and I'm not convinced that we're where we need to be yet. I know that that foreign sources tried to probe and enter not only the president's race, and as we know with the hacking in of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. But I would suspect some other federal races as well in different state databases in terms of voter ID. The FBI and others have assured us that they're doing everything that they can. We want to make sure that they, A, have the resources to do that, and be ahead of, and be a step ahead or two of the bad guys, because they're going to try. And I'd like to think that the answer is going to be absolutely secure, but it's, you know, you got to spend the resources to make sure that they are. And I know it'll be something that we continue to look at in a bipartisan way. And I compliment the speaker for asking for some of these classified meetings, Speaker Pelosi, again, that have been bipartisan. I know that the Senate has sat through some of those same classified briefings. And, you know, we need to be, you know, this is not something we can sweep under the rug, nor should we ever.
Is there a concern here that even if you don't have hacking, that people lose confidence in the system?
There is yeah, absolutely. You're right on. I mean, the ballot is secret that you cast. I know that when I go to vote, so I vote in St. Joe, and I feel confident that the voting machines there are clean and secure. I know for me in my township or precinct, you know, I usually fill in a circle or connect a line. There's a provision now that we didn't used to have that, you know, particularly in primary elections, if you somehow by accident crossed over, maybe vote for Carl Levin and vote for Fred Upton in the same primary, the machine now will spit that out. Carl Levin, of course, being a former Democratic senator mm-hmm. from here. But the machine would spit that out before you actually submitted it. It said, uh-oh, you know, you got to vote on one side, Republican or the other, Democrat,
rather
or independent.
Rather than just spoil your ballot.
Yeah, and rather than spoil your ballot.
Give you a chance
and that
to
happened.
Go back.
You know, it's amazing. You know, as you talk to some of the clerks back then, before this technology was there, you'd have maybe 5-10% of ballots spoiled because people actually, you know, they didn't understand the directions or go through. So now that's been able to be corrected. But the other thing is, those ballots that I cast, yes, they take off the, you know, the 7-number serial number at the top and tear it and put it in the machine, but they actually save the ballots so that if there is some issue, they won't be able to track it to me, but they'll say, you know, if we have to hand count them, they can. Takes a lot longer, but they can.
There's been a lot of talk about trying to change votes, and most of the conclusions are that there was not a vote changed after it was cast in 2016. But is that really the place to look? Should we perhaps be looking at voter registration records? Could someone get into a computer and change someone's registration and perhaps do it, you know, in areas? You know, we know a lot now about how people vote by area,
et cetera. I suppose that happens. Again, you know, for us, Southwest Michigan, you know, there's a lot of confidence, I think, in the clerks that we have, county clerks as well as township or city clerks. I know that, again, when I go in to vote, I'm in precinct one, and they've got the printout of all the names, and they highlight it in a yellow marker, you know, when someone comes to vote, so you don't vote twice. I suppose and I know that when people fail to bring, remember, in Michigan, you need to bring an ID. But if you don't have one or lost or whatever, you can still cast a provisional ballot, i.e., you know, it's incumbent upon you. You sign an affidavit that's there. Now, it's going to change a little bit. Voters, of course, changed. We have same-day voter registration. I would say that there is some concern, I would imagine, that someone might have voted in, you know, one community and they show up someplace else. And they don't necessarily have a, you know, same-day registration now. Maybe they don't have a new utility bill or property, you know, whatever it might be to try and verify their address at 100 Main Street. And I think, I don't know, again, this is more of a state issue, they'd still be allowed to vote, but maybe they voted absentee at the other place. They're not going to find that until it's too late because, you know, the votes get counted and certified within generally a few days of the election.
But is the problem that people are trying to vote in a couple of different places, or is the problem that we have, you know, people hacking
records? At least for us, you know, they have a printout, a physical printout, not just on the computer screen. But when I go into St. Joe City Hall, they have a computer printout of all the names. I mean, it's on paper.
Okay.
And that's the match that they do. I'm I'm checked three or four times. I mean, your voter, you show your driver's license, you sign a statement, you give your birth date. You know, people look at you compared to the great photo license that we have from the DMV. But I think my sense is that people feel that it's pretty secure. And again, I know people that have gone without a driver's license and they still fill out the provisional license. To my knowledge, no one's been denied. But again, that's more of, you know, that's a, you know, we need to talk to Tim Snow here and others. Are
more
know,
of a state and local issue.
County clerk.
Do you think that there is specific legislation that Congress should be working on in terms of security to work on hacking
those
sort of things?
We've passed some funds for that and to reward states or encourage states to improve the standards that they have. I think that's a worthwhile thing. But you got to remember, for most of these elections, you know, a federal election, yes, I'm on the ballot. Gary Peters, yes, he's on the ballot. But most of those names on the ballot, you know, particularly in the what's now is the off year, you got the governor, you know, et cetera. But you've got a lot more state and local officials on the ballot than the federal ones. And it's really the states have been, quote, certified to really manage and run those things. Yes, I think we need to provide some resources. The FBI has assured us that they're working with all of the secretaries of states across the country, trying to make sure that their systems are as fail-safe as they can be. We always do hear about some issues. I heard last week there was some community, I want to say it was in Florida, but maybe it was in Georgia, where someone voted and the machine actually transferred the vote to the other party. If that's true, it needs to be looked at. How do we prevent that from happening again? We want to try and prevent that type of abuse wherever it might be.
You're a member of the Climate Solutions Caucus. What sort of climate solutions are you working on right now?
Well, actually, a couple. So I'm also a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus. And, climate change is real. I was one of the few Republicans that actually spoke out when the president pulled out of the Paris Accord. Then we were one of only two countries, and now we're the only one. Nicaragua has now signed the accord. But as most caucuses, and I'm a member of 30 or 40 of them, from Great Lakes to Auto to, you know, you name it. There are a lot of good – they're all bipartisan. It's often a staff-driven issue in that they're looking at bills that have been co-sponsored and sponsored by members within the caucus. They have meetings that generally members themselves aren't attending. It's more of a staff function. But it also shows where people are. And, you know, when you have a vote on something, the caucus may put out a little memo that goes to the legislative aides, the legislative directors, just reminder, it's the, you know, DeGette Amendment on methane. And, you know, most of us, you know, there's a telephone chain of sharing information on a variety of different issues. I know earlier this year I helped write an op-ed that was co-sponsored or co-authored with Greg Walden, my successor as chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and John Shimkus, the chairman of the – I shouldn't say chairman, now the top Republican of the Environment Subcommittee, acknowledging climate change is real. What are some of the things that we can do to combat it? What is it that we can do on energy efficiencies? We're going to see some bills reach the House floor, I think – this month, September now, that we passed out a committee, whether it be weatherization monies with a substantial increase, a number of energy efficient pieces of legislation. For me, I've always supported an all of the above energy policy. So, you know, nuclear needs to be part of that mix. Remember, there's no emissions, carbon emissions from nuclear reactors. I was delighted earlier this week to help break ground on a new natural gas energy electric facility in Niles. You know, it's 50% the emissions of coal. Actually, it's better than that, than coal. And we're going to be retiring, I think, a dozen coal plants here in Michigan. So it's just sort of part of the, you know, what we need to be doing as a leader on reducing emissions and showing the rest of the world.
The UN panel on climate change has said that things are going to get pretty bad by 2050 if we don't get down to net zero carbon emissions. Can we get there?
You know, that's going to be pretty hard. I just confess it'll be pretty hard, but we're making progress. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, back in the 2000s, I don't remember which year, but Michigan embarked on being 15% renewable, i.e. no emissions, by the year 2015. We did it. In fact, we actually exceed that. And we are on a path now without any real big push. And Patty Poppe was here in town a couple weeks ago, maybe it was in July, CEO of Consumers Energy. And she's quite proud and said this at the Mackinac Detroit conference in the spring. And for some time, we're not going to be at 15 or 16% as we are today, but we're going to be at 40% renewable by the year 2040. I think we're going to do better than that, actually.
So should Michigan be some sort of a model for the
nation?
Well,
we are. Actually, we are. I know that when I go back to Washington in the next week, and I don't know when this is going to air, but I'm working with my colleague Diana DeGette on some national legislation that can, I think, speed up, ramp up, you know, where we're going to get on renewable. I know that my vote a number of years ago on wind and solar tax credits saved the industry. You know, it's exciting to see the solar fields that are out there here on campus, but all around the state. I met with some folks on the wind turbine, you know, which we're seeing really produce a lot of different energy. So we're moving in the right direction, and if we can provide a boost to that to get, you know, again, it'll be hard to get to 0% emission, but we're certainly making a lot of progress here for sure in Michigan. But what can we do, you know, in states, you know, again, for us, even though we're, you know, quote, a northern state, we do pretty well on solar. And, you know, we don't maybe do, you know, we know where the wind is, but we're better than a lot of states. We're working with the utilities to make sure that that electricity, in fact, gets into the grid. And there are savings there. I know in California, they've got a new law now that every new house that's built has to be solar. They've got to have solar panels on the roofs. And you're beginning to see that just as you drive around in, you know, different states. I was in Vermont for a wedding last week. And, you know, a lot of houses there are now beginning to get the solar panels on the roof. It's an exciting thing. And it wouldn't have happened had we not done the tax credit a few years ago.
Do you need more things like that? And I guess,
yeah, I think we need more incentives. You know, I'm looking forward to getting back and talking to the auto industry in terms of where we are on emissions. You know, the transportation sector is a big player in terms of where things are. I'm looking, you know, energy appliance standards I've been a big supporter of. And, you know, I know that, you know, my new water heater that I got not too long ago is a distinct improvement over the one that was put in, you know, way before I owned the house. Windows, insulation, all those things are important, and they're pretty. And you know, when you look at autos and the CAFE mileage standards that are there, it's important that we continue to make progress on those fronts. And I think we're doing it, and we should continue to do it, and show the rest of the world what we can do here.
As you say, climate change is real.
Yeah, it is.
Is it an urgent enough matter yet that that we're going to move fast enough to get this done?
Well, it. Yeah, it's people know that it's happening. That is for sure, and that's why it was important that, you know, particularly from our committee standpoint, energy and commerce, that really the three biggest leaders, the former chairman, actually two, count me, but the top Republican on the committee and the two subcommittees together confirming that, and you know, let's look at things where we can work together to really reduce our emissions. We are all better off. It's like, you know, it's like trying to limit plastic pollution. And, you know, we did a big bill that I worked on with Frank Pallone, now the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, banning microbeads. And, you know, we're going to probably see us do more, which is a good thing.
You have said that you would support some sort of a red flag law regarding guns. How would that work in your mind?
Yeah, so here's what red flag does. We have about 20 states now that have it, Florida being a recent one. You know, the day before the Parkland shooting, I visit a school generally every week. Actually, I think this week it's been five. The day before Parkland, I was at Portage Central. I spoke to about 300 or 400 middle schoolers who came over from next door. While I was there, they had a live shooting drill at the high school. They never had that when I was in school. They're pretty scary, actually, and just, you know. So the next day was Parkland. The next day, or the next week, I was back at Kalamazoo Central with a meeting with, we had Sheriff Fuller, we had a number of the local superintendents, Portage, Kalamazoo, and others, Vicksburg, I think, Schoolcraft. We had some mental health folks, Jeff Patton from this area, who's very accomplished, all, you know, and student leaders, and teachers and others, probably a few other people that I don't remember right away. But we talked about school safety. I met with some of the students that survived Parkland. I met actually in July of this year with a dad who lost his son as well. And what red flags do is a number of states now have it. It probably would have stopped Parkland from happening. It allows with tips to law enforcement for them to go and investigate as to whether an individual is harmed to themselves or to others. And if that determination is made with due process, the law enforcement group is able to retrieve those weapons, hold them, and wait for the process to go forward. But, in essence, put a wall up to prevent that individual from doing that. So there's money for training law enforcement to make the right decisions. And this is not a new thing. And so I'm a co-sponsor, have been, in the last Congress, didn't go anywhere. This Congress is introduced in this last spring. I'm hoping to see a version of this reach the House floor before the month is out. But the bill that I co-sponsored, you know, it's actually called the Deutsch. He's the congressman from Parkland. Deutsch Brooks, former U.S. attorney, Republican from Indianapolis. Upton Dingell, Debbie Dingell from Michigan. The four of us are the lead bipartisan co-sponsors. This is the Jake Laird Act, named after an individual who died. But it has been used in Indiana for years. Governor Mike Pence, you know him? He had it under him. He didn't sign it into law, but it was there. I think Mitch Daniels may have. But if it's good enough for – and it's been used hundreds of times. If it's good enough for Indiana, why isn't it good enough for the rest of the country? Now, Michigan is not one of the states. I think it's been introduced here. Or it's, I don't know, one of our states. But this is what I call another tool in the toolbox to prevent something from happening, whether it be a Parkland or El Paso – Odessa, you know, Dayton, you know, Columbine. It's another tool, and with proper due process, ought to be something that can be bipartisan.
25-plus years ago, you voted for a ban on assault weapons, correct?
Yeah, actually, the New York Times called me today. They wanted to reflect back on those votes.
Would you vote for it again?
So I voted for – it was a comprehensive bill of which the assault weapon ban was part of it. And I don't know if it'd be in the New York Times or not, but I talked to this reporter for length earlier today. But it was a comprehensive bill, and one of the concerns about the assault weapon ban, which was in place for 10 years and then it expired, and it was not renewed under Republican or Democratic speakers or presidents, right? It wasn't ever part of the mix. But one of the concerns was that if you changed one piece of the definition, i.e. the scope, the stock, whatever, all of a sudden that weapon would no longer be such, and you know, you'd create a giant loophole. Interesting, I talked to the BATF earlier this week, and they said during that 10 years, they weren't aware of it ever being used except in criminal cases in sentencing, but now it really hasn't. In other words, you could still possess it, but unless you actually use it in a crime, it was more of a sentencing guideline. But the crime bill of 94 did a whole number of things. It provided what was called midnight basketball, but it allowed inmates to actually have something to do versus being, you know, on a bed or, you know, change
a wall.
And also,
there's also the idea, I think in that risk, you know, in low income neighborhoods, that sort of thing. So it wasn't right. necessarily people
it,
already
It had a lot of things. It, yeah. it included a COPS program. So communities that couldn't afford police on the beat, you'd have more community policing. There was an incentive program that's still around today. You expanded background checks, something I always have supported. You know, I voted for the Brady Bill. I can remember when we had the terrible shootings here, six people killed. Sheriff Fuller reached out to me to tell me what happened just a few hours before that. I remember it was about midnight. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm so glad I voted for the Brady Bill years ago, because if he hadn't done that, I mean, in something like this, you know, it's just awful.
You're referring to 2016 and the Jason Dalton.
Well, in the 90s. In the 90s, I actually voted for the Brady Bill. But you're right. Yeah, the incident that happened.
Sheriff Fuller's. Yep. Okay.
So it's, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. The gun violence is, you know, at the top of everybody's list right now. And so I'm a vice chair of the Problem Solvers, a bipartisan group of about 50 members. Right now, we had a conference call this last week. We're actually writing up some principles to see where does our group stand on red flag and some other issues. And the way that our group works is if you can get 75% consensus, we will vote for it as a block. And so we're involved in that now. I'd like to think that we can get a consensus, particularly on red flag. Again, due process needs to be part of that. And we'll see where it takes us in the next couple of weeks.
All right. We started with politics. I'm going to end with politics. A number of Republicans, former office holders, a couple of people I think you have served with in Congress, Republicans, have said that they are either going to or are thinking about challenging President Trump in a Republican primary next year. Is that healthy for the party?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know if I'll skirt it or not. You tell me. You often have primaries. Remember, he won, President Trump. The primary was 17 people. He was the only one that I never met. And he won. Maybe that's the secret. I don't know the secret sauce. I think at this point, with just a few months before we get to the New Hampshire caucus and Iowa and everything else, he has a pretty good lock on the Republican base. Most pundits think it's 85% or 90%. It's going to be pretty hard to crack. I know William Weld announced a number of months ago. I don't know that he's raised more than $1 million or $2 million. I know John Kasich went to New Hampshire again, I think this last week, and he was a very viable candidate 3 years ago, you know, in the 2016 race. And he won our area. John Kasich won our district in the Republican primary. Great record as governor of Ohio, former chairman of the House Budget Committee, decent guy in every respect. But even John, and he was at the Mackinac Conference with me back in May, John would, I think, still publicly say that, you know, he's not interested in this thing. So, you know, it's no one's going to challenge the president in a meaningful way, let alone get it. You know, it's hard to get through these ballot or signature rules to even get on the ballot. So, your question, is it healthy or not? It's always healthy, but at the end of the day, it ain't happening.
In 2016, you never endorsed Donald Trump for president of the United States.
You are correct.
Will you endorse his reelection in 2020?
Well, I don't. I'm not ready to make a decision now. You're right. I said then we're staying in our own lane. I didn't get involved in the primary. I didn't endorse any of the candidates. I had really a tough time because, again, I knew 16 of the 17 of them.
But you also never endorsed him in the general election.
Correct. I did not. And I said, look, we're staying in our own lane. I'm going to just focus on my race. I don't know him. Never met him. I didn't go to the convention. I didn't meet him until, frankly, the night he gave his State of the Union address, which was, you know, a month or so into his term. And, you know, he hasn't asked me. Usually you got to ask someone, right? You got to ask people for their vote. Got to ask. So he's not done that. We'll see. But it's, you know, again, I'm not a candidate yet because we got a ways to go.
Congressman Fred Upton, as always, thank you for your time.
You bet. Always good to see you. Thank you.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.